All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome, both those of you here with us on campus and those watching online. Welcome to this third talk in our War in the Middle East series. My name is Danny Hoffman. I am the director of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington. Now, let me begin, as we always do at our Jackson School public events, by acknowledging that we are meeting on Coast Salish territory, the traditional homelands of the Duwamish, Suquamish, Tulalip, Muckleshoot, and other indigenous peoples. The Jackson School understands that the international community includes sovereign American Indian tribes, First Nations, and other indigenous peoples across the world. Now, I'm very pleased that tonight we welcome a member of our own community, University of Washington Professor Karam Dana, to the stage to lend his expertise to this ongoing conversation. Tonight's talk, The Question of Palestine and the Evolution of Solidarity and Resistance in the U.S., is an important contribution to our collective conversation and to our collective understanding. So in just a moment, I'll invite to the stage Dr. Rashad Kasaba, professor and former director of the Jackson School, to properly introduce Dr. Dana and then to moderate the Q&A afterward. Before I do that, a couple of quick details. First, I want to remind you that, as we have done for the previous talks in the series, we'll be using slido.com. That platform will be the tool for asking questions. Whether you're in person or watching on the live stream, if you would like to ask a question, you go to slido.com, that's S-L-I-D-O.com, and then you'll be asked in the event to type in an event code. The event code for tonight is hashtag or pound Dana, D-A-N-A, so you just spell that out, okay? Second, I want to take just a moment to thank the many people who have worked very hard to make this series possible. I'd like to thank UW President Cause, Provost Serio, and everyone in their offices for this support. The Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Diane Harris, Divisional Dean for Social Sciences, Andrea Woody, and everyone in their offices and in the College of Arts and Sciences Communication and Advancement teams. Everybody has put a lot into this, and we're grateful for that. I'd like to thank everyone at the Jackson Foundation for their partnership and their support. And within the school, my gratitude to the faculty and staff affiliated with the Middle East Center, Strom Center for Jewish Studies, the IT and communications teams, and especially to Monique Thorman for her careful planning and very hard work. And most importantly, once again, I want to thank all of you for caring enough about an informed, thoughtful public discourse to be here tonight, and to Dr. Kasaba and Dr. Dana for lending their expertise. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Rashad Kasaba.
Thank you, Danny, and thank you all for coming once again. It's great to see all of you here. When we started this series, our hope was to create a space to have informed conversation about a very important topic. From everything I've heard from my students and from online comments, I think we have already accomplished a big part of that, and hopefully as we move forward, this complicated picture will become somewhat clearer in our minds. At least we will be informed enough to talk and also to ask questions. I am very, very pleased to introduce Karam. When you teach at a place long enough, you come to a point where you see that people you've met as students have accomplished great things, and you take pride from that. So Karam was born and raised in the city of Al-Halil, which is also known as Hebron in Palestine. He is the Allison McGregor Distinguished Professor of Excellence and Transformative Research at the University of Washington, Bothell. Dr. Dana is also the founding director of the American Muslim Research Institute. Karam studies Palestinian identity and transnationalism and the effects of Israeli occupation on Palestinian society. In addition to the study of Palestine-related questions, Dr. Dana was one of the earliest scholars to study Arab and Muslim racialization in the post-9/11 era. He's done that through survey and public opinion research. His accomplishments have been recognized both inside and outside the classroom. He was the recipient of the 2018 Distinguished Teaching Award and more recently the 2023 Distinguished Research Scholarship Creative Activities Award. I'm looking forward to Karam's presentation, and then I will, afterwards, I will come back to moderate the Q&A. Thank you.
Everyone, can you all hear me well? Okay, perfect. Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much to everyone who has worked on putting this event together. Before I begin, and I usually don't do this, but I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs related to the talk today. And I usually don't necessarily talk about my own personal identity, but I think it's very important to know and understand that positionality actually matters with regards to who you are. And in fact, being, you know, having a certain type of positionality makes you interested in studying certain things that others may not understand. And in fact, as far as I'm concerned, that renders it a great deal of strength, in my opinion, the scholarship that is. I'm one of a handful of Palestinian faculty members at the University of Washington, literally a handful. And to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only member who was born and raised in Palestine. If you know someone, please let them get in touch, other than myself. I see my job having a great sense of responsibility associated with it. Obviously, I happen to be Palestinian, but I also have certain types of insight into my own society. And I've been able, obviously, having lived in the United States for more than two decades, have been able to understand certain things related to American society, and I've lived in this society, and I am part of this society. As you might imagine, as a Palestinian scholar, I refuse to be tokenized, of course, and never have had conditions when I speak, and never been forced into specific agendas to be spoken, that I'm part of these types of things. I refuse anything that might affect the substance and quality of my scholarship and my personal identity as Palestinian. I'm done with this one. So I just wanted to mention that my own personal position as a Palestinian American provides me with a certain level of with a responsibility, but also sometimes it gets a little bit hard with regards to which invitations to accept and which invitations not to accept. But I'm very delighted to accept today's invitation because I feel that the voice and the research that I have actually, that I will be sharing with you today is necessary and important. Okay, can we switch to the PowerPoint, please? Okay. We all notice that there's an intensifying polarization in the U.S. It seems, however, that it parallels Israeli violence against Palestinians. Every time there's something that happens in Palestine, it seems that the intensity of the reaction also intensifies in the context of the U.S. This intensification takes place in law, legislations around the United States, commerce, education, and pop culture. How has Palestine and Palestinians been talked about in the context of the United States? This is something that I will be answering throughout the talk today. But also, I also would like to mention and talk about how Palestinians have been able to accomplish wider global and transnational reach to understand their own plight for justice. There are multiple socioeconomic and sociopolitical transformations that have materialized around the world, but in the US in particular, over the past two decades or so, that have played a role in advancing the message and narratives of Palestinians, as I will be describing. What are they and how they came to exist? Palestine has now become central to American politics, whether you like it or not. In fact, it has always been central to American politics. It's just that the quote-unquote mainstream, for the lack of a better word, is now discovering that it is central to American politics. Now, I want to focus on the Palestinian presence transnationally and in the world about the experiences and perspectives of Palestinians living in what is known as Ashatat in Arabic, or Al-Ghurba, which means also exile or living in outside of your own homeland. played a critical role in shaping the opinions and policies of the communities in which they reside and interact with. And more importantly, is that it also played a role in shaping the nature of resistance outside of Palestine, not in Palestine, but rather external to Palestine. More than 60%, actually about two-thirds of all Palestinians that live on the face of this earth live outside of Palestine. They are refugees, they live in exile. So Palestinian presence is transnational. But what's more important for me here is that they hold a memory of a place, of a culture, of a people, of a nation, and they keep it alive without having an independent nation state as we could imagine. And the interesting thing is that they keep going in the sense that you don't see that actually stopping. But if anything, it's intensifying the intensity of Palestinian identity. This is somewhat of a unique situation that has affected the agency of the Palestinian people living in a transnational space. And this transnational characteristic of their existence in the global socio-political and economic landscape has given them new opportunities and created solidarity and also a stronger shared national identity of Palestinians. What's interesting is that Palestinians, even if they've never actually set foot in historic Palestine or mandatory Palestine, they still identify as Palestinians. And it's very interesting, as I will be describing, that there is a high level of linked fate between Palestinians that live inside Palestine and outside of Palestine. Okay, a quick timeline, but it doesn't look very quick. But I'm going to focus on a couple of those, if you don't mind. The problem of Palestine actually begins in Europe, as we all know. The laws and the European nation-state concept excluded Jewish people in Europe, as we all know. In the sense, I mean, we can go on and on in the details of this, but we don't have the time to do that today. I'm happy to respond over email if you have any specific questions related to this. But the European nation state concept excluded Jewish people, and in the sense that provided the Jewish people with the necessity, it actually created the necessity for Jewish people to establish their own nation state. Hence, the publication of Der Judenstaat, German for the Jewish the Jewish homeland, published by Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism, arguing that the Jewish people have to have their own homeland if they are to be excluded from European forms of nationalism. I'm going to fast forward here, if you don't mind, and to talk about 1948, of course, which, when the largely immigrant Jewish population in Palestine declared a state, sparking what is known as the Nakba. The Nakba is an Arabic word. We all know what Nakba is, but let me just explain it. Nakba means the catastrophe. It refers to the ongoing, in fact, not only that it started in 1948, but it's an ongoing catastrophe that Palestinians have to live through every day. And it continues, unfortunately. About 950, the numbers vary somewhat, 750,000 up to a million, somewhere around that. They became refugees, and they were forced out or escaping threat of violence during that time. Now, Israel was founded on 77% of mandatory Palestine. The remaining areas, West Bank and Gaza Strip, they were controlled by Transjordan, now known as Jordan, and Egypt, respectively. I'm talking about important milestones, if I may. 1965, the PLO was established, a secular nationalist organization that operates as an umbrella for different factions of resistance within Palestinian diaspora, primarily. In 1967, we remember that in 1967, the Six-Day War led Israel to triple in terms of its size in 6 days. And there was an interesting question, obviously, I mean, Six-Day War, but there's an interesting question within Israeli debate that was taking place within the Israeli government. Moshe Dayan, for example, an Israeli political figure, writes in his memoirs that we didn't know what we're going to do. Shall we provide everyone with equal citizenships or not? Equal citizenship to the Jewish people or not? Because now you have a great deal of population that is not Jewish under the control of Israel. And the answer, unfortunately, was no, we're not going to give them equal citizenship. In fact, Palestinians that live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip from 1967 onwards had a fourth class level citizenship. Palestinians in the West Bank had a color ID orange. Palestinians that live in the Gaza Strip had a color ID that's red. And then Palestinians that live in East Jerusalem, also occupied in 1967, and the Golan Heights, also occupied in 1967, held a blue identification card that looks like the Israeli identification card. However, it is different with regards to its privileges and access, accessibility in terms of what it actually means. So I just wanted to mention here that there's a multi-layer level of rights that are associated with what happened after 1967. In 1987, an important thing happened. The Palestinians rebelled against colonialism, effectively, sparking what is known as the First Intifada. Intifada, for lack of a better word, it's a revolution. Intifada is uprising, or it actually means yantafid, which means like to shake off from the roots. Okay. But it's a metaphor for revolution against the colonizer. And then Hamas was founded the same year. Hamas is, in fact, an acronym for those who don't necessarily know this. It stands for Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya Hamas. Hamas is the word itself means, this is kind of interesting 411 sober information, Hamas, the word itself means enthusiasm. So, but it is a form of resistance that has a religious component associated with it. 1993, the Oslo Accords were signed, and it created what is known as peace through separation, to on the principle that two states will be established side by side, the Palestinian state will be established in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And what's interesting about this is that within 5 years, this will be established. Obviously, that didn't happen. But if I had personally, I remember those days, you know, not necessarily my own personal experience is that important, but what happened is that the separation itself created layers of problems moving forward. And let me explain. Prior to 1967, prior to 1993, there was more interaction between Palestinians and Israelis on a regular basis and throughout the West Bank, throughout the Gaza Strip, in Jerusalem, and Palestinians would be able to go from one place to another. After 1993, that ceased to happen. So from my perspective, I feel that that Israelis, they don't think of Palestinians in ways as, you know, they don't interact with Palestinians in a normal way. They interact with them through that security framework. So they judge in the sense they kind of start thinking about the Palestinianness as something that that isn't normal, that is not a day-to-day type of interaction with people. So I actually feel that there's a great deal of damage that had happened within that separation. But in addition to this, the separation that took place since 1993 and on was focused also primarily on separating Palestinians from Palestinians. So there's a form of destruction of society that was taking place, similar in some fashion to what happened in 1948. 1948 was a significant moment whereby Palestinian society was destroyed. A majority of Palestinian society became refugees. As I will describe later, that we all think of this as a weakness, but as I will describe, this has become a strength. I can go on down the list, but one thing I want to emphasize here is that 2000, the second Intifada took place, and it basically kind of was a result of the frustration of Palestinians with the peace process. And what's interesting about the second Intifada is that it brought a new level of violence that wasn't necessarily witnessed. Tanks in the streets. Not that tanks were not in the streets in 1967 and other times, but in 2002, April in particular, the incursion of the West Bank was one of the most violent moments that Palestinians had never really witnessed something like this prior to that. And I think that that's important from my perspective. I argue that this violence led Palestinians to start thinking of new ways of resistance. If you stand against Israeli military, you try to confront the Israeli military, you're going to lose. So they started thinking beyond that. And in 2005, BDS, a social movement known as boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and I will be describing more about that in a few minutes. BDS was established. And it was a campaign triggered by 70 or so civil society leaders within Palestine to actually try to, in a sense, internationalize their struggle, to go out and kind of reach new populations and to also talk about questions related to their own plight and to also spread knowledge about the question of Palestine. And that becomes important, as I will describe. But I think that launching BDS in 2005 was a reaction to the level of violence that we had seen. As I mentioned earlier, the violence itself creates sort of reactions that themselves create other forms of reaction and so on. And over time, that intensifies. And I notice this every time there's an episode of violence and an episode of confrontation, it gets more and more intense as we move along. I want to end with, in terms of the timeline here, with five major wars, obviously, on Gaza. These are the five wars, and of course, we are in the last one currently. There's about 28,000 Palestinians and counting dead. And I also wanted to mention the whole quote-unquote acts of genocide. Evoking effectively Madeleine Albright's response with regards to the Rwandan genocide. Was there a genocide? And Albright's answer was, well, there were acts of genocide that had taken place. But from my perspective, this really signals that that definitions are obviously political. And we have to think about that as we talk about reasons as to why people define it as genocide or don't. At any rate, we can talk about that in the Q&A. One other thing I wanted to mention is the proposed partition plan of 1947. The United Nations provided a plan to partition Palestine, providing 56% of mandatory Palestine for the Jewish people. Forgive me. I thought that this is connected to that, so I apologize. So this is the timeline. Okay. All right. Here's the slide with regards to wars on Gaza. And here's the map of the partition plan, UN Resolution 181. But when Israel was established and the Nakba was parked a year later, as you see, there is more lands that were actually occupied on which Israel was created. And that ended up being 77% of Palestine. Anyway, just mapping and providing you with some context that you might want to look at. Okay, the West Bank is very small. Palestine and Israel, West Bank, Gaza, it's a very small geographic area. And the West Bank is the size of Delaware. It's tiny. Delaware is one of the smaller states, obviously. The Gaza Strip is the size of Philadelphia. And here's how they are in relation to Israel from 1948. And of course, the Golan Heights are up north. As you can imagine, they belong obviously to Syria. Well, not according to Trump, but anyway. The Golan Heights were occupied in 1967. Okay. I also want to show you how life looks like in the West Bank briefly before I move forward. The Oslo Accords provided different kind of categorization of the territories in the West Bank into Area A, Area B, Area C. Area A are where Palestinian concentrations take place. Area B is controlled by Palestinians and Israeli forces in terms of security. And then Area C is fully under the Israeli authorities. This is from 2002, by the way. And as you can imagine, things have gotten a lot worse than they have. This is from OCHA, Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, United Nations office, of course. And this map was actually released in 2003. It actually shows different types of control, physical control, going from one place to another. Okay, and from my perspective, this previous map and this map they look like Swiss cheese. And of course, you hear that analogy quite often. But the sad reality is that if you look here into this right here, you will find that the wall, which is the red line that is visible in the map, is actually taking part of Palestinian territory, part of the West Bank. So this is why sometimes Israel is called an apartheid state. It is because one continuous piece of land that has one particular legal, international legal status, whereas you have different people with different legal rights, if that makes sense. Okay, I mean, let me explain. From the perspective of Israel, Israelis that live in the settlements, Israeli settlements, they have civil law taking care of issues related to them. If there's a problem, there's a crime, that's how it's dealt with. But with regards to Palestinians, it's actually a different law. It's military law. And they're, yet at the same time, if we imagine two crimes happening within the same continuous piece of land that has a similar international legal status, this obviously becomes a problem. Hence the term apartheid emerging to say, you know, that there are layers of different layers of security, different layers of privilege based on your own ethnic background. If you don't know what settlements look like, and I know this is quite available, but I found it over the years, I've been doing this for two decades or so, that people actually don't know what settlements look like. The housing that is closer to the camera is an Israeli settlement. Okay. The one further in the back is a Palestinian town. Look at the proximity. Actually, this is still far. I mean, there are, like, you find two homes right next to each other oftentimes. Here's another image of what settlements look like. The one further from the camera is a settlement, Israeli settlement, and the closer one is a Palestinian village. Now, as we are trying to answer the question of the global change with regards to how Palestine is thought of and talked about, I want to contextualize it with a public opinion survey I had done in 2013. Yes, it's old, but it's important. Excuse me. I conducted this survey in the West Bank to measure attitudes and opinions in relation to a variety of questions, just like all social scientists would do. But I was more concerned with the 20 years post-Oslo. What has Oslo done for Palestinians 20 years down the road? The Oslo Accords, the signing of the Oslo Accords. I'm happy to discuss the methodology for those who love methodology afterwards. But in a sense, it was 832 representative sample from around the West Bank. I tried to do it in the Gaza Strip, but I was categorically rejected, at any rate. Okay, so observations, and I will discuss in a minute. I'm sorry, I'm going to show you some graphs, but I'll try to make them not boring, as least boring as possible. But what's interesting, certain observations that come out of the survey, is that there's a serious support for transnationally focused approach with regards to dealing with the question of Palestine and Israel, meaning that if you have grievances as Palestinian, you're trying to think about external forces that would address the concerns you're dealing with. That's one. Two, all forms of resistance, according to how people were thinking, were seen as legitimate, okay, including nonviolent and violent, right? And I'll tell you why that's important, because in a sense, oftentimes we always talk about Palestinians having the so-called, you know, armed resistance, which is something that Palestinians have done and continue to do. But at the same time, they also think about that as legitimate form of resistance, as do a lot of international legal scholars. And then in addition to that, they also think about nonviolence as a legitimate form of and also effective form, as I will show in a minute. Now, I want to zoom in a little bit more. Palestinians understand the importance of public relations globally and spreading more accurate knowledge about their struggle for justice, according to the survey, as I will show in a minute. Soon after the outbreak of the Second Intifada, the campaign, BDS campaign that I mentioned earlier, emerged. While it was transnational in focus and in nature, it focused on Western countries primarily. Now, Palestinians, as I mentioned, exist and live in transnational settings, allowing for more effective communication across difference, meaning that that those Palestinians living in different places understand those contexts in which they live. Okay? like if you happen to be Palestinian Seattleite, you're able to speak to other people who are Seattleists, etc. Now, global presence of Palestinians and the usage of quote-unquote non-violent strategies to address Israeli occupation have in fact determined the next course of action on how they frame their plight. The perceived effectiveness of two transnationally focused strategies has led to creating shifts in public opinion, as I argue, regarding the question of Palestine, but especially in the United States. Let me explain that again. One of the questions that I asked is, which of the following, or how effective is this particular, let me go here. The perceived effectiveness is a question that I wanted, that I asked Palestinians with regards to addressing concerns related to the occupation. What I've noticed
is that there's a new form of identity that is being formed. And I'm not necessarily saying that Palestinian transnational identity or to think about it as such didn't necessarily exist prior to this. But I'll explain in a little bit. Palestinians lived transnationally, but there's more of a linked faith component that has gotten stronger over time. Now, transnational existence has transformed into strength rather than weakness, which is quite interesting because we've always thought of the Nakba as something that has destroyed Palestinian society. But if anything, the Nakba, in fact, led to the strength of global Palestinian existence. And this is something that is noticeable, and I'll happy to talk more about this in the Q&A, but in more details, you know, the intentional, I think I'm using my words here, the intentional destruction and dismemberment of Palestinian society in 1967 led to creating communities that are beyond the control of Israel, that are actually fighting Israel in ways that they cannot control. Now, linked fate, a term and a concept we measure oftentimes when we study BIPOC communities or communities of color. We would ask Latinx communities, if something happens to other Latinx individuals, does that affect your life? And it's a measure that we use in minority politics in the US for that. So I applied that to the question of Palestine. Linked faith among Palestinians inside and outside of Palestine is quite high, comparatively speaking. Palestine has already, by the time I measured this, has already transcended the definitions of geography. And it's no longer a geography-defined issue per se. Not to say that Palestine doesn't matter itself, the geography itself, but rather the reach of Palestine has gone beyond that. It has become a transnational phenomenon. And I also would like a side note, if I may. This isn't the first time that transnationalization of Palestine, or actually, they used to call it internationalization of the Palestinian cause back in the day. And it's not the first time this is happening. It happened. But rather, there was a serious level of critique that comes with it, because internationalizing a cause meant your disconnection to the cause. And you find a lot of leftist Palestinian factions focusing on internationalizing it, internationalizing the question of Palestine as part of the larger Marxist approach to the global proletariat and different regimes around the world. So that there was an effort to think along those lines, but that effort was always critiqued heavily by Palestinians themselves as something that would actually might affect how Palestinians see themselves, and their cause would become one that is not connected to the land. So that was rejected. However, in the 2002 onwards time period, as we have seen, things have changed. The geography is disappearing. Okay, so, sorry, graphs and tables, so I apologize. Okay. I wanted to highlight a few results, if I may. I asked Palestinians with regards to how they think about Westerners, okay? And what's interesting to me is that Palestinians are somewhat you know, complicated with regards to that question. It's not just simply, well, I like them and I don't like them. But there's nuance to it. There's nuance whereby there's positive feelings towards people, but negative feelings towards governments, as you can see. So 38% say positive towards people, but negative towards government. 19%, et cetera. As you can see, this is very self-explanatory. But what's interesting, I wrote once an article about this, using this data. Okay. It wasn't me. It should be there, right? I'm actually using a computer there, not here, but. Sure. This is not connected. Well, I could connect it to my laptop.
What does HDMI stand for?
Okay.
That's HDMI. So this is why we were doing it in the back of the room, and I have no idea what just happened because nobody touched anything.
Okay. I'm not sure how to proceed, honestly. Okay. Sorry, everyone. If it's getting too complicated, I'm happy to do it without, if that's okay. Should I go without it? Okay, all right, thank you, I'm sorry. Wow, never ceases to surprise you. At any rate, technology, I suppose. At any rate, okay, all right, okay. Okay, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Positive feelings towards people, negative feelings towards governments. And there's a level of sophistication associated with this, as I mentioned, and I'll describe why. Typically, when we study anti-Western feelings around the world, we just actually say, oh, they just hate Americans. There's no nuance associated with this. If it turned out that that's actually not the case. It turned out that Palestinians, and by and large, have done other surveys that actually prove this similarly, that, in fact, people in the Arabic-speaking world primarily, they see the two separate, and they think about them separate. They assign certain types of values, in a sense, to each. And the interesting, I actually wrote an article around the Trump ban efforts, if you all recall that, in which I looked at what happens to people who travel to the West, interaction with the West, and what is, you know, how do they feel with regards to Western feelings. It turned out that people who had positive feelings towards people and negative feelings towards government, if they come to the United States, they will have more positive feeling towards people, but actually more negative feelings towards government. And if anything, that actually tells you certain ways, I mean, they tend to be racialized in Western societies and by the Western governments. At any rate, that's a different story. Now, some notes associated with this, as I mentioned, is that there's a clear distinction among Palestinians and other Arab nations. They all effectively follow similar patterns. That there's a clear distinction between people and governments. In a sense, it means that Western countries' foreign policy, US and EU, can be critiqued and viewed negatively, but without holding similar feelings about the people of these countries, if that makes sense. And that's an interesting finding in by itself. Now, the question of linked fate that I mentioned earlier, a question I asked, do you think what happens to Palestinians outside of Palestine, Mandatory Palestine, affects your life? And then the answer, as you can see, these are really high numbers, comparatively speaking. Okay, now,
With the Oslo Accords and the Palestinian Authority, I had to ask a few questions with regards to how the U.S. involvement in the question, dealing with the question of peace process. In 2013, Secretary of State John Kerry has been quite involved with attempts to find a solution. In your opinion, will these efforts be, and I asked that question, 60-some percent said unsuccessful. Obviously, it shows that Palestinians see the role of the United States in ways that that's not necessarily favorable with regards to their position with regards to Palestine and Israel. And I also asked questions with regards to the Palestinian Authority. Should the Palestinian Authority be dismantled? And the interesting thing is about 62% said yes. Actually, no, I'm sorry, 60% said no, keep it. And here's the interesting thing. You would suspect that Palestinians, 20 years after the Oslo Accords, would actually be, nope, we don't want it, let's do something else, right? But if anything, it told me that Palestinians were happy having to exercise a form of their own identity, having a Palestinian passport, having having a Palestinian police, maybe. And again, there's a critique, obviously, to that, and I'm not necessarily saying that the Palestinian Authority has been the kind of providing the best possible governance. But I think it's important to recognize that. And once I asked that question, I realized that my survey is pretty good, because I asked, how satisfied are you with the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority? And you had a lot of people who were dissatisfied. And that, to me, signaled that that I'm really doing something important. And one of the questions is I asked, based on your experience, based on the way you see the peace process between the Palestinians and the Israelis, when do you think peace will actually take place? When will it be achieved? 29% said never. Okay. And that's, I'll stop at that. Based on your experience with the Oslo Accords, 20 years living in the West Bank, should the Palestinians continue to seek a peace agreement with Israel to achieve a long-lasting peace? And 71%, no. And I'll describe in a little bit. These results are a reflection of pessimism and frustration, in case you didn't notice that. 70% of the sample should think that they should no longer seek peace with Israel because they will always lose. And this is an answer that I was able to reach out through focus groups with regards to this particular point. About 30% of the sample feels that the peace will never be achieved, which is quite high. And then Palestinians see the role of the United States that is hasn't necessarily been in their favor. U.S. has always, unfortunately, been as quote-unquote dishonest broker, which happens to be the title of Rashid Khalidi's book on that very topic, you know, the U.S. as the dishonest broker. So two major results that I'd like to share. And I really, from my perspective, I wanted to see how Palestinians focus on certain types of support. What does support for certain types of resistance look like? And then in addition to that, what are the most effective forms of resistance? So what type of resistance, first of all, support? Do you support this form of resistance or not? And then the second one is to actually dig deeper in it, if I may. All the social scientists here, they're all like nodding, yes. In a sense, to actually ask about what is the most effective, what are the most effective strategies or approaches. And so, sorry. The study measured support, as I mentioned, of effectiveness of a variety of questions. And I measured nonviolence and efficacy of building solidarity, et cetera, around the world, and BDS, support for BDS. And I will show you in a little bit. This is how I started the questions. It has been 2 decades since the signing of the Oslo Accord. Based on what you have witnessed and experienced, what would be the most effective and rewarding method to deal with Israel and Israeli occupation in your view? 0 being not effective at all, 5 being very effective. And again, you don't have to look at it too much, but I'll show, because I have a graph. I have a nice picture after that, so you don't have to look at this much. But in a sense, you know, resist Israeli occupation in any way possible, including armed resistance, okay? And here's what this looks like. It's skewed to the right. They're not all tables, okay? I have some pictures here. And then the second question is,
resist in nonviolent ways and surrender at the same time all forms of violence. Okay? And it looks like this. Also skewed to the right. Perceived effectiveness of boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. And as you can see, it looks actually quite similar to the others. So there's effectively, there's a perceived effectiveness to it. Perceived effectiveness of lobbying in Western societies with regards to the question of Palestine and to provide more of an even-handed position. And that's what it looks like. Now, what do they tell us, these results? Even though times seem difficult for Palestinians, their self-determination with a U.S. foreign policy that has challenged their claim of legitimacy it looks like it's a serious problem. Even though that happens, there are a number of transformations that are taking place that I believe, at least, it's signaling that it will reverse in the current this current condition in the future. As I want to highlight the idea of the Palestinians in exile have agency, and there's now a conscious move towards a non-geography-bound approach in the face of disappearing geography, intensifying human rights violations and deteriorating Palestinian living conditions. So there's now to think about living conditions and the situation that's happening in the occupied Palestinian territories and in Palestine proper, then, you know, what is that gonna, what do you do? So then thinking beyond the physical, thinking outside of the physical geography becomes important. Now, Palestinians and their allies will continue to present their case to Western audiences and governments and obviously the ICJ. This is based on the ways in which Palestinians have thought of the efficacy, as I mentioned earlier. But then, similarly, BDS, as an expression of a nonviolent strategy, seems to be expanding. I mean, BDS is expanding as a campaign globally. But before that, I also want to mention the fact that there are there's a focus on forging new connections and solidarities with other oppressed communities in the U.S. BLM, LGBTQ, by the way, and indigenous struggles in the U.S. and elsewhere as well. Now, globally, particularly in the U.S., as we notice, sympathies towards Palestinian struggle have been traditionally non-existent, but have become quite common these days. Now, the backlash against the May 2021 physical expulsion of Palestinian inhabitants of the Sheikh Jarrah was internationally felt, that there was a backlash against that in ways that we hadn't really seen previously as much. The ongoing war and unprecedented level of violence against Palestinians in Gaza, obviously, and the West Bank, have brought about the largest backlash to date and shifted American views on U.S. foreign policy and Israeli practices. And I will, as I will show you, there's a 10% drop in support for Israel in a month. It's not my data, but it's data that I found and, in a sense, reported by Reuters, a study done in October 12th through 13th of 2023. The question, there was a 41% support for the following statement: U.S. should support Israel. And then a month later, see, October 12, 13, a month later, November 14, that number drops to 32, from 41 to 32. That's a massive, massive drop in public opinion in the month. Now, let's talk a little bit more about how we, you know, what's the story? Why is it that Americans hold these sorts of feelings? And I think I spent a great deal of my book that's coming out soon on this very question. You know, how do Americans think of Palestine and why? How do they get those feelings? I've always personally thought that it was quite interesting that Palestinian struggle was not necessarily seen as a legitimate one. And for a variety of reasons, because, I mean, one would think that in the United States, the perception is that, the perception of America in the United States is that The underdog is something that we should always, a person and you know, a group or the underdog is important in terms of how we focus on a variety of different struggles, but not necessarily with the Palestinians. Okay, now there's an erasure of Palestinian identity, obviously, because in a sense this is what settler colonialism does, right? And its legitimacy in the United States context, the legitimacy of Palestinian identity and Palestinian call for justice, is one that is seen through a variety of different lens. There's a historical whitewashing and the defense of Israeli violence as a right to self-defense without any question. There are, of course, Orientalist views of Arabs and Muslims that have dominated public discourse in the US for a long time. Now, American Christianity is quite interesting because it influences, obviously, the perceptions of Israel and, by extension, perceptions of Palestine and Palestinians. To varying degrees, the majority of Christian denominations in the U.S. see Israel as a fulfillment of Christian belief and prophecy. The ways in which American society views Israel, I'm sorry, views Palestine, Palestinian, Arabic-speaking peoples, Islam, the state of Israel, and Judaism are obviously all interconnected. And once you have one definition of one, everything else is related to it. So I think once we get ourselves out of this particular piece, we can get somewhere after that, I think. But at any rate, so political advocacy groups have strengthened social and political ties. That's another reason as to why there's a strong relationship between Israel and the United States, but also portraying and having a negative, not necessarily very positive feelings of Palestinians in the American imagination. But there are advocacy groups like AIPAC, we all know that organization, of course, ADL, for example, and then State of Israel-sponsored trips for educators and other professionals that tend to kind of strengthen different the connections between the two societies and two countries as well. And I can go on in details at this. I've spent a lot of time, of course, researching this. There are some Palestine-related advocacy groups similar to them, but they're not as powerful and they're really not that effective. And of course, education in the US has frequently been biased against Palestinians in the Middle East and Islam. And of course, in general, K-12 education, and again, there's a lot of nuance associated with this, so I'm generalizing here, if I may. There is a limited exposure to global issues, unfortunately. And media portrayals of Arabic-speaking people have traditionally been negative, of course, again, following the Orientalist ways through which Palestine has been perceived in American society. Now, there are structural barriers to the Palestinian story. Palestinian narrative is either absent or perceived as illegitimate. And that's some of the, this is one of the difficulties to try to change with regards to the question of Palestine, to change the views about Palestinians and so on. But there is a changing time. There's something that we have noticed happening for quite some time. There are a couple of quotes here from a former director of Human Rights Watch, Middle East North Africa Division, in the sense talking about that there's now, there are no longer regurgitated stale defenses of Israel's right to exist, quote, terrorist and anti-Semitism as a new recognition of Palestinian rights. That there's some change that is happening, right? And then again, there's the question of apartheid as well that is emerging. Matt Duss, former foreign policy advisor for Bernie Sanders, a graduate of the Jackson School, by the way, I think new tools of activism are important, and since he highlights the fact that social media plays a very significant role for Palestinians, democratizing media, the democratizing of media. But then in the sense that it's not necessarily, which I agree with this statement wholeheartedly, it's not to overstate the significance of Twitter itself, it's just a platform. So in the sense that there's something that has that provided more people more Palestinians to hear the story of Palestine, but also for Palestinians to share their story. And in a sense, the Palestinians have been able to use them effectively, you know, evoking Edward Said's very famous word, the permission to narrate, right, their own history.
But then in the sense that Palestinian sentiment in the United States has been changing. But then there are larger background to this particular change that I'm talking about. The rise of the internet over the past 30 or so years and the decline of traditional media meant that everyday Americans have access to Palestinian voices. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that it's easy, but they have more access to Palestinian voices and a better understanding of the quote-unquote complex issues surrounding the question of Palestine and Israel. And then, more importantly, the ability to document the events and spread information through social media platforms that are also obviously internet-based, but that's significant. Over a 30-year period, a lot has changed technologically speaking. The broad landscape of religious attendance in the United States, that's another reason, has been undergoing a seismic decline since the last quarter of the 20th century, as I will show. Regular church attendance has become less of a cultural matter in the United States. Now, I also there's a caveat to this. When people are not necessarily going to church, it doesn't mean that they're less religious. There's a little complication associated with this that I'm happy to discuss if needed. There's also, more importantly from my perspective, there's a growing number of Jewish Americans and Israeli individuals and groups who are actually speaking out and recognizing credible accusations of human rights violations perpetrated by Israel. And many are showing tremendous courage in standing up against them. Now, there are things that are changing the perceptions with regards to Palestine and Israel in the United States. There are, in American society now, there are new definitions of equality, equity, solidarity, and intersectionality, as we all know. I'm happy to interrogate that more. There are changing conversations around legitimacy of established institutions, governments, and policies. The BLM movement has been very significant in its impact on American society with regards to new definitions of equity and so on. And there is also solidarity that is taking place within BIPOC communities transnationally that are capable effectively, around solidarity building with other rabbi communities. But what to me, this last point of new generation, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an ageist piece of information here that I'm sharing, this somewhat a new generation, new ideas, capable of framing the plight of Palestinians in ways understood by others of different ethnic and racial backgrounds and priorities. So I think that also played a very significant role with regards to this. Okay, wow. Now, why now? Why is this shift taking place right now? In the United States, over the past 20 or so years, I argue that different U.S.-based social justice movements were motivated in response to the militarization of the police in the United States and the increased surveillance under which the average citizen lives, not only people who are specifically targeted, but the larger American society. These policies were, in turn, a response to the World Trade Organization events in Seattle. A lot of people have actually pinpointed that the WTO events, I was there, by the way, 1999, the battle for Seattle, right? And then the securitization that emerged and the perceived attacks on personal liberties in the name of security after September 11th. In a sense, these are processes that have led to a change. Now, I want to show some iconography here, how Ferguson and Palestine, different forms of solidarity have been taking place. Here's another picture. A delegation from Ferguson in Palestine taking pictures. Here's Black Lives Matter, a Palestinian resistance, and how they are tied together, and then the ties that bind. Now, there's also a connection that has always been around between black politics and Palestine. And again, these are just simple examples, but James Baldwin went and visited Israel. Actually, Israel invited James Baldwin to visit in the 1960s, in which he discovered something very interesting, that he noticed that the ways through which Palestinians and Arabs are treated by Israel was one that he had experienced as a black man in America. And then there are other anecdotes that are interesting, like, you know, a student going to the West Bank and seeing Trayvon Martin murals on the separation wall or apartheid wall. Understanding, in the sense, Palestinians are understanding that their plight is not the only plight out there, but it is connected to other struggles. Now, of course, Angela Davis, Cornel West, and Mark Lamont Hill, and a few other important figures. And it's funny, Coates was not necessarily pro-Palestinian at the beginning. Actually, this past summer, 2023, he went to Palestine for the first time. And he was always writing about Zionism and why is it important and so on. And he was a very ardent Zionist. He goes to Palestine over the summer, comes back and starts writing things that are different. And in fact, he was one of the pundits that you sometimes see on television in recent weeks talking about the question of Palestine. Because he had situations that he witnessed that made him remember how it looks like to be black in America, and particularly in the South, right? At any rate, here's more iconography, if I may. Indigenous and American, Native American solidarity from Palestine to Standing Rock. That's something that is really changed a lot of the public opinions with regards to how Americans see the question of Palestine. And then I also want to mention that the salience of settler colonialism is something, that concept, is really actually catching on fire. I mean, it's, if you get interrogated through focus groups, there's something very salient about that. And then I'll try to do this rather quickly, 5 minutes or so, but there is a changing landscape for Christianity in the United States. Americans born between 1981 and 2000 are, quote, according to this Pew study, right, quote, the most ethnically and racially diverse cohort of youth in the nation's history, end quote. Then again, quote, the most politically progressive age group in modern history, end group. And, quote, the least religiously observant youth since research began charting religious behavior, unquote. So there's something really interesting about this generation with regards to the Christian, quote-unquote, Christian ethic and its connection to American society. And then that has been taking place not only recently, but as you can see here, there has been a great decline with religiosity in the United States going down, as we can see here. And there's one more graph, weekly attendance of churches between 1993 to 2020. As you can see, it is going subsiding effectively. By generation, if we actually break that down by generation, as you can see, the millennials are the ones who go to church least. But overall, they're all it's all going down. And then another change that I'd like to highlight here is that there's a changing Jewish American and Israeli, obviously, we all know that, views on the question of Palestine. June, July 2021, a survey of Jewish Americans found that a quarter of the respondents agree with the statement that Israel is an apartheid state. That's massive. Same survey, vast majority report an emotional connection to Israel. What does that mean? Is that there's a connection to the idea of Israel, but Israel, the manifestation in terms of politics, it looks like something they don't necessarily like. A November 2022 survey of Jewish Americans found that, quote, only 4% of Jewish voters said that Israel was one of their top two issues in deciding who they vote for in Congress. 89% of Jewish voters agreed that, quote, someone can be critical of Israeli government policies and still be pro-Israel, end quote. 72% of the Jewish voters disapprove of AIPAC endorsing and raising money for members of Congress who support Israel, but voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election. So there's something interesting about what's happening within the Jewish American community. And then there have been voices of prominent Jewish scholars and Jewish figures in the United States. Gabor Mate, for example, the famous psychologist who was born in a concentration camp. Sarah Roy, Noam Chomsky, Peter Beinart, Judith Butler and others, who are actually like effectively creating new ways to think about the question of Palestine within the Jewish American community. Now, I also want to highlight that there's the phenomena of the new historians, or historianim hachadashim in Hebrew. It's a concept that was coined by Benny Morris, talking about how these new historians are thinking about the founding of the State of Israel in ways that wasn't necessarily reported as such. So in a sense, they were able to access archival material that others hadn't been able to access, and were able to provide new information and reach new conclusions about the founding of the State of Israel. And we all know different organizations in the United States and in Israel, like Beit Salem, Peace Now, Combatants for Peace. They're varying with regards to what they think about with regards to the question of Palestine and Israel. Combatants for Peace, if not now, is an American organization of Jewish Americans standing against occupation, Breaking the Silence, and Jewish Voices for Peace, a very prominent organization in the United States. I also want to highlight that this was published in an Israeli newspaper in 2018, where it was an ad for a boycott, for boycotting Israel. And you found that for something like this to happen in Israeli society, it really there's effectively messaging that is taking place inside Israel about boycott. And then BDS has been gaining momentum, including in Israel, and especially that there are Holocaust survivors who signed and approved of BDS against Israel. As you can see, this was from 2014. Natalie Portman, an Israeli-American actress and artist, as we all know, rejected an award that was presented to her by the State of Israel. And of course, it is seen as a as kind of a betrayal, effectively, that they're giving a victory, that she gave a victory to boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Now, this actually came out yesterday. These are rabbis who are part of the Jewish Voices for Peace, and they wrote a letter to President Biden the day before Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I'm just going to put a little quote here. "We are compelled to speak with moral clarity about what is happening to Palestinians. We do so not in spite of our histories, but because of them." And that actually brings me to the concept of tikkun olam, which is a Jewish ethic. Does anyone know what tikkun olam is? Anyone raise your hand? Yeah. Please.
Repair the world.
Yes, thank you. Repair the world. Fixing and repairing the world. It's a Jewish ethic. So in a sense, you find a lot of campaigns within Jewish American community highlighting the significance of social justice. I mean, social justice is a very significant factor with regards to the idea of Judaism. It's important to the identity of Jewish Americans. And I want to give a shout out to my colleague, Devin Narr, who's sitting right up here, who actually brought this to my attention a few years ago. Immanuel Kant, 1798. Says, quote, "The Palestinians living among us, since their exile, or at least the great majority of them, have earned the not unfounded reputation of being cheaters on account of the spirit of usury." He's actually talking about Jewish people in Europe, and he called them the Palestinians. And to me, that actually highlights something interesting, that the presence of Palestinians in a transnational setting, in fact, parallels global Jewry previously, right? And there's a lot more in common to the experience of the Jewish people to that of the Palestinian experience that is taken and unfolding today. Now, other changes that are happening with regards to labor support for BDS, I'm just gonna move forward and to show multiple things that are happening with regards to support for the changes that are happening with support for BDS around the United States. Bernard College, this is a vote for BDS that took place in 2018, for example. Actually, this happened last night. University of Michigan Faculty Senate voted for the divestment from any company invested in Israeli war in Gaza. And then we all know that pro-Palestinian students demand divestment from Israel, and that's actually quite increasing now, especially after the war had started. And then I also want to mention that the fact that there have been police exchanges between different cities in the United States, and sometimes campuses, actually, with the state of Israel. Okay, and then Durham, North Carolina, in fact, voted unanimously in 2018 to cut any future police exchanges. Now, there's also changes within the Presbyterian Church, divesting from different stocks that are supportive of Israel, and so on. And there's, from my perspective, there's a change that is taking place in on a number of fronts in the United States, and so on. But also, I want to highlight that there's a cultural boycott, of course. You know, artists have taken stands and not playing and not performing in Israel. Due to the violations of human rights. Now, with the current war that we are dealing with today, unfortunately, the typical response continues. The U.S. supports Israel despite popular disapproval. Mainstream media has been supportive and biased towards Israel, unfortunately, as we all can see. And I can talk more about this. There have been a call for ceasefire, but the Biden administration continues to ignore that. I'm going to jump, if I may, to this very last slide. This reads, وَحُبُوبُ سُنْبُلَةٍ تَمُوتُ سَتَمْلَأُ الْوَادِي سَنَابِلْ. It means the seeds of a dying ear of wheat will fill the valley with ears of wheat. And it was a poem by the late Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. This, as far as I'm concerned, is very symbolic of the situation that happened to Palestinians, that the Palestinian destruction that took place led to increasing possibilities of pressuring against or exerting pressure against the injustice that they had to endure. Thank you very much for listening to me and for enduring. Thank you.
So just want to remind you that we'll take the questions as they come through Slido, and I will try to get to as many of them as we can, as quickly as we can. So I know there are a lot of questions, so let me just get on this. Okay. So I'll just go through, because really we're short on time, but we will try to stay a little longer than our time. So thank you so much, Karam. Gave us a lot to think about. What impact does the International Court of Justice's finding of plausibility of genocide done by Israel on Palestinians have on the liberation movement?
That's a very important question. I actually think it's a very significant ruling from my perspective. It is the first time in 75 years that you will find Israel not having or enjoying the impunity that they've had for a long time. So the very simple fact that there is now talk of plausibility of genocide, I mean, you know, not necessarily genocide, but we're almost there type of a situation, I think that's a very significant finding that will, in my opinion, have to transform how Israel deals with the Palestinians, but also the global community's views of Israel will change. Because I think now there are a lot of conversations around the legitimacy of violence that Israel perpetrates against Palestinians.
Okay. If you have been following student activism for Palestinian liberation on campus, what is your response to this?
So I'm at the University of Washington, Bothell, so I'm not daily on this campus. I have voiced my disapproval of the fact that students were forcefully asked and then forcefully removed from the president's suite. The president knows my views on this, and I think that we could have figured it out in a different way. And I believe that Palestinians need space to talk about injustice of their people, and they need to be able to voice their concerns and voice their dissatisfaction with the world around us. And I also want to highlight the fact that campuses is where it's at. The civil rights movement, we're talking about the 60s, the 70s, this is where it's at. And I'm not necessarily saying that sometimes every cause is one that should occupy most of our attention, but I do believe that that there needs to be more conversations around how to address concerns related to Palestinians. The interesting thing about Orientalism is that Palestinian is commingled with Muslim, commingled with Arab. These multiple concepts coming together that don't necessarily mean much. So you find a lot of people suffering from the current events in Palestine. And then for them to feel that they are being silenced. I don't want anyone to be silent. Not Palestinians, not Israelis, not Jewish, not Arab. Everyone should have the ability to speak up. So I just want to mention this, and President Kausay knows this. I have voiced my personal disapproval of that fact. I would have handled it differently, but I understand that there are other considerations that take place with making decisions like this.
Actually, this question touches on something that you mentioned. Before 1948, some Jews living in Palestine who spoke Arabic or Ladino could be considered Palestinian. We saw an example there. Is it possible to be Jewish and Palestinian today?
That's a hypothetical, but yes, there were Jewish Arabs before 1948, and actually there are Jewish Arabs today in different countries around the world. One thing I want to highlight is, given the circumstances of the current unfolding conflict, we would have to think about certain political formulations before a Jewish person who's an Arab to live, say, under the authority of the Palestinians, for example. Is it possible anyone can be Palestinian? Anyone can be, just like we can think of everyone can be American. I don't think that anyone is to be excluded from any definition. So there's always, I still think that I'm part of the Ottoman Empire.
Of course, they're all Turks, actually.
We're all Turks at the end of the day. But I think it's important for us to recognize that there is a great diversity that has taken place in the region. I don't like the term Middle East, by the way, even though I teach Middle East politics. The new term is SWANA, Southwest Asia, North Africa, much more inclusive, includes non-Arabs as well, not non-Arabic speakers in the region. So SWANA, Southwest Asia, North Africa, the region. I think there's a great level of diversity that we need to pay attention to. And as far as I'm concerned, it's what makes this region very unique. And I also want to mention one more thing with regards to the word Middle East. Middle East is a Eurocentric term, obviously. The Middle East is it's the only region in the world that is actually defined by people who are not indigenous to the region. Okay. So I'm just saying that tells you the sort of what power, in fact, means at the end of the day. Power dictates meanings. In Arabic, Sharq al-Awsat wasn't necessarily used by the people of the region, right? But now you find it. They use it because there's no, for the lack of a better term. We try to do swana in Arabic. That's a little bit interesting. But anyway.
So this is interesting because when I was in graduate school many, many years ago at State New York and Binghamton, we did have a SWANA center, and we had to, I was a student then, and people always wondered what it was all about. This is almost 50 years ago now, so I don't know if it still exists.
That's great.
It was like a unique kind of place at the time.
That's definitely unique. Yeah.
So why, this is a question that comes up very frequently, why didn't the Palestinians accept any of the opportunities they encountered over the last decades to form their own state?
Okay, that's a good question and a legitimate question. My answer represents me. I don't represent anyone. I don't speak on behalf of anyone. From an objective point of view, from an objective analysis, I do not believe that it was the right decision, for example, to introduce the partition plan like they did, okay, like the United Nations. And I also want to mention that in 1948 there was other partitions taking place. It was the era of partitioning things, right? I mean, India and Pakistan, obviously. So there's something very significant about that time period, and the ability of the United Nations to take on these conflicts and to try to say, oh, well, let's give this to that, right? I don't think it was the right approach. I didn't live during that time period, but the fact that the Palestinians rejected the partition plan in 1947 was only the natural response that anyone would give. Moving forward, Palestinians have not had many opportunities to get their own state in the way you think they do. I'm sorry, I'm being very frank with you. Even the so-called generous offer in 2000, remember that, last-minute shuttle diplomacy, and I'm sure a lot of us remember those days when Bill Clinton was stepping down and tried to do a lot of the efforts very quickly. That generous offer turned out to not necessarily be a generous offer. I mean, in the sense, it was an offer that will be rejected by the Palestinian people if Yasser Arafat had gone to the Palestinian people and had a referendum. There's no question about it. Because it actually, there's major levels of concession. So why, I mean, but also another question is why do we not think in creative ways? To answer that question, and I'm very thankful for the person who answered this question, or persons. Why don't we think in new innovative ways where we can think people of different backgrounds, ethnic, religious, national identities of any sort, can live in a pluralistic society with equal rights? Potentially, right? And as far as I'm concerned, we all know that justice is important. We all understand that ultimately we know how to answer the question of Palestine. We know. It just, from now until then, how many more pain are we as humanity, obviously, first and foremost, how much pain Palestinians do have to endure, okay? And to an extent, Israelis, of course. But then the humanity, I mean, we are part of this as well. So why hasn't Palestinians accepted a permanent settlement? Because nothing has been serious in front of it. And I also want to mention at the same time that, I mean, between 1993 to 2000, settlement construction was supposed to stop. It actually accelerated. And that's important. I mean, that's important for us to recognize as well.
So this is about Hamas. Hamas leaders have repeatedly stated that their goal is to wipe out Jews and the state of Israel. Why doesn't the left and the West believe them?
That's an interesting question.
ask the left, but I don't
know. No, I mean the question. I understand the question.
Yeah,
trust me, I understand the question. A couple of things. And it's interesting, any question about Hamas has legal implications, I also want to mention. Then if someone asks the question, is, do you condemn Hamas? And, you know, whether you do or you don't, there's legal implications associated with it, because Hamas is considered to be a terrorist organization in the United States. So if I say yes or no, there's a catch associated with this, if I may. So at any rate, that's not the question, so I'm not dealing with it. But I want to talk about, I mean, look, whether you like Hamas or not, if Israeli occupation didn't exist, Hamas would not have existed. End of story. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. So the next two questions are very similar, so I'll kind of ask them together, variations of the same. How do Jewish and Palestinian narratives of exile influence and shape each other? And the next one is, do you see any parallels between the diasporic identities of Palestinians and those of Jewish people, both before and after 1948?
Beautiful. I think this is a great question, because I feel like this is at the center of the conversation that I have spent years trying to figure out, right? I mean, I think when I shared that when I shared that slide, Immanuel Kant's slide, talking about the Jewish people,
as terrible stereotypically, in a very stereotypical way, that they like money and usury, etc., but calling them Palestinian. So, I mean, there are a great deal of parallels, if I may, between how the experience of Jewish people being racialized in Europe and so on, and then the Palestinians being racialized through the lens of Orientalism globally, but also with being in Palestine and being subjugated to that treatment. And I also want to mention one more thing, just adding a different layer of answer to this question, which is in relation to how the two narratives speak to each other. American Jewish community has, again, I'm not Jewish, so I'm just sitting on the sidelines, and I would love for this situation to be over. Trust me, I think about it every single day. Ask my kids, they will tell you that. I think the Jewish American community, just from my perspective, has a very serious conversation to be had internally. And over time, things have been changing within the Jewish American community with regards to how the question of Palestine is to be talked about and be perceived. Look, you go to most synagogues in the United States have an Israeli flag. Now, Israel has existed for 75 years, whereas Judaism has existed for thousands of years. I mean, I'm talking about, they're two separate things. Sure, they're somewhat connected, but we have to put things in perspective, if I may. So it's a serious conversation that people have to think about their own Jewish identity ethic, if I may, mm-hmm. to Kun Olam and others, and the progressive ethic that is inherent to being Jewish globally, right? To think about justice. Justice is at the center of it, okay? And I think it's, within the Jewish American community, I am told by my friends that the question of Palestine is what determines someone's progressive level of politics, you know? What do you stand on Palestine? And in a sense, there's a division that is taking place within Jewish American communities. And sooner or later, everyone has to think about that question. And look, may I add another piece to this? I'm not saying it's easy. Far from it. It's not easy to have a grandmother, grandfather, or some relative who experience atrocities. It's not easy. And then you hear a certain story, and then you're emotionally invested in it. It's not easy to get rid of it. It's not easy to step behind. And I'm not necessarily trying to pontificate here. All I'm trying to say is that it's a serious conversation about one's identity. Are Jewish Americans ardent about support of Israel that actually commits crimes? Or are they really ardent about their own identity as Jewish Americans with regards to a variety of different ethics and beliefs that are central to the Jewish tradition, that actually, as far as I'm concerned, led the Jewish community through the global Jewry and the persecution that they had to deal with and so on, and came out on the other end of it, right? So it's very important for us to understand that the experiences of the Jewish people before 1948, globally, as I said, this is a Euro problem, you know, are central. I mean, the experiences are central to the experience of Palestinians today. And will continue to be, because as far as I'm concerned, Palestinians now see their struggle. And it's an irony of sorts that the Palestinian condition now is one that parallels the experience of global Jewry. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question fully, but...
That's very good. So I've been getting from my students the frustration that they don't have enough time to engage in this, but that's, as I said earlier, that this is a conversation that will go on.
I'll come back.
Here and beyond. And you'll come back. And then you also said you're open to email.
Did I say that?
So I will ask one last question, though, which I think is a good way of ending this. And that's about, goes like this. What actions can an American citizen undertake to fight for a permanent ceasefire and for Palestinian liberation?
There are layers of this. I would say educate yourself. Read. Know what's going on out there. Understand history. Be critical. Critical skills are sadly very hard to come by these days.
And it's not necessarily that that we don't know how to do how to be critical. It's just simply there are a lot of other variables that are taking place that make it hard for us to be critical, especially if we are contained to the level of information that we're exposed to, that it determines our entire global outlook through this very tiny kind of binocular, if I may. So that's the first part. Educate, read, know, ask. It's okay. This is a great deal of information out there. And I'm not sure who said this, but the truth is out there. I mean, like, if you want to know about Palestine, you will know about Palestine. And again, you hear anecdotal stories of Israelis who were extremely pro-Israel of their own country and all that. And Simona Sharoni, for example, who's a feminist scholar, used to be at Evergreen, now in the Northeast. Simona was an IDF soldier. And then only one time she saw a refugee, because she would drive around Jericho, Ariha, the town of Jericho, and there was a refugee camp that she had thought that it was a dumpster. And then one night she was at night driving, and there were lights in this dumpster. So she calls her a friend or a relative, saying, like, there are lights in that dumpster. And they're like, that's a refugee camp. She's like, what refugee camp? I mean, there's a lot of knowledge that is, there's a knowledge deficit about Palestine. I think this is how we do this. We need to understand, one. Two, talk to your representatives. Two. And besides, I mean, when someone named, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be stereotypical, but if a Caucasian-sounding name calls and sends a message to someone who is, I'm not going to mention names, but to my representative who, they will actually, it will have some sort of more weight, if I may, rather than someone named Ahmad Muhammad, for example. I'm being honest, it has more weight. I mean, it's this sad, absolute sad reality. Because whose Americanness is more worthy than the other? And it's a reflection of this society. I mean, hetero, straight, male, typically white, obviously, right? We all know that. We all know this. So I think it's very important for us to speak up. And also, that's another. In addition to that, it's okay to have difficult conversations. In fact, I encourage them. I do. If a synagogue invites me to speak, I will speak under certain conditions. I don't want to be tokenized. I'd rather not be tokenized. But if a synagogue asks me to come and say, hey, can you please come and talk to us? I'm happy to do it, 100%. I will accept the invitation. I'm telling you that right now. But the question that I'm more concerned with is when we start thinking of our humanity as one that is similar to another person's humanity, when we're able to see our own struggle through other people's struggle, when we can see other people's struggles through our own. And again, this is a simple concept called empathy, for God's sake, right? Once we start understanding that, we will get somewhere. But until then, unfortunately, there will be a lot more dead people. Mm. And I just hope that we can learn how to be able to have conversations and effectively be part of a change, a long-lasting, forever type of change. I'm waiting for that day.
Well, Karam, thank you so much. This is, I know.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.